The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for November 8th, 2018, the Way Too Much News Edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in a friend's bedroom in San Francisco, California. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is in New Haven. John Dickerson of CBS is in New York. And on this week's show, an extraordinary election leads to perhaps an ordinary outcome. It's more or less what was predicted, but with enormous consequences for the nation. We will chew that over and digest it. Then, could this election reshape voting rights in America? There has been so much discussion about voting rights, ballot access, who gets to vote. Did this election mark a turning point in that big fight? And then, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has been fired. That is an Attorney General that I will not miss, or will I? We will discuss. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, we are going to do our annual Conundrum Show, December 12th at NYU's Skirball Center in Manhattan. There are tickets at slate.com/live. It is our delightful evening of contemplation, fighting, agreeable, jolly fighting, and insight into human nature and into the grand questions of life. So you should please come and join us at our Conundrum Show. And we're going to have a great special guest, Simon Doonan, who's the judge on Making It, that wonderful television show, who is really such great company and so much fun to be around and is such a wise and fun person. He's going to join us at that show. So come see us and Simon contemplate conundrums on December 12th, slate.com/live for tickets. Tuesday night marked the most anticipated midterm election of my lifetime, I think. We had extraordinary results in the House and the Senate and in some governor's races, but it netted out roughly where people expected. Democrats slightly outperformed their House expectations. Republicans slightly outperformed their Senate expectations, but not much in either case. And there was a mixed bag in the governor's races. Democrats lost big races in big states. On the other hand, they knocked off Scott Walker. They took the governor's mansions back in Michigan and Illinois. They dinged Kris Kobach. They won a bunch of House seats they had no business winning. John Dickerson, what is the story of this election?
Well, there are, you know, so many different storylines of the election, but I think the big, big story election is that people were looking for a referendum about the president, and I think you got a split decision. I think you got in the Senate, you have the structural challenges for Democrats, which played out, which is that Democrats lost in red states. Even if Donald Trump weren't the president, you would expect that to happen. The country has stopped splitting tickets, so you have senators who tend to come from the state of the party of the presidential candidate who wins their state. So Donald Trump won those states. It's likely that senators are going to be Republicans from that state. But for, as far as the president is concerned, it did ratify the strength of his coalition and his tactics. Remember, this campaign was really about the president choosing to go his own way, even different than what some Republicans were talking about, emphasizing the border, emphasizing those identity issues. Then totally different message in the House, that Republicans were defending 60 of 65 battleground seats. You not only had Democrats winning in areas that look more like the country, that look more like the what the battleground will be in the general election in 2020, but you also had this extraordinary number of women, people of color, people from the LGBT community being sent to Washington. It's so I think it drove the divisions in the country actually more to be more divided, and sort of each side got a boost for itself, which means not only how will that, you know, that's going to affect governing going forward, but it also is going to affect the way people interpret and read things going into the next presidential election, kind of with both sides seeing plenty of vindication for their own views.
You're talking about it as a split decision because of the way the Senate is chosen versus the House. But when you look at the popular vote total across the country, Democrats won by a large margin, right? We're up in like the 8 and 9% range. And so is it really a split decision, or is it a split decision as filtered through America's political system?
Yes.
And, okay.
Yes. Correct. Yes, it's the former. It's the former. The signal coming from that's I guess what I was trying to say when I meant the electorate that sent more Democrats to the House is closer to the electorate that will be important for 2020 and is closer to it's just a larger and more representative portion of the country than the Senate, which was had all kind of sort of structural issues with that. So, yes, it's a split decision. I just meant in terms of the way the two parties will see it. But I think in terms of the what signal did we get from this, which is the first response from the voters, official response from the voters, the stronger one comes from the House. So I think that's so you're right.
Right. And then I just feel like this raises all these questions about this increasing gap or strain on our constitutional system where we see effectively non-majoritarian sets of voters wielding more and more power in a way that is a contradiction or in conflict with what more of the country seems to want. It's complicated, obviously, because even though turnout was high, it's not everybody. But that still is this increasing challenge that we're seeing.
Right, exacerbated by the particular map of this cycle. The next cycle, for example, in the Senate, Republicans are defending a map that looks bad for them. And so you could imagine a situation next cycle where Democrats have big victories on the Senate side. It wouldn't reflect the point you just made, which isn't to say that the point you just made about representation and the American system isn't one worth debating. I'm just saying this particular map exacerbated what you're talking about.
Yeah, that makes sense. Although the 2020 map is kind of problematic for Democrats, too, in the Senate, isn't it? I mean, or it doesn't, at least it's not clear what will happen, we have the same kind of.
It's a lot better for Senate Democrats than this one was. And then we should also add in the signal sent by the governor's races. I mean, because you had victories in Michigan and Wisconsin, which completely reverse what some people were saying, I think overreading it, but some people were saying about 2016 and President Trump's victories in the Midwest. You saw a return of Democratic strength in the Midwest and in Ohio in the Senate race, not the governor's race, but you saw a return of strength from Democrats in the Midwest that completely reverses the storyline people were taking out of the 2016 victories from Donald Trump there.
Right. Though then you see these losses in the South with, probably with Stacey Abrams in Georgia and Andrew Gillum in Florida. And I would add Beto O'Rourke in the Senate in Texas. These were the three most exciting Democratic kind of new candidates of this election. None of them will be in office. And
well, I think, although Texas and Georgia are such a steep climb, Florida is the interesting one because it's a split purple state. So that was the one where you really see the forces of the left and right against each other in equal measure. Whereas, you could imagine Texas and Georgia in 4 or 8 years being a more favorable landscape for Democrats than now. Some people would argue that Abrams and O'Rourke did incredibly well, given how far they had to go, given the natural politics of those states.
But Emily, do you read the Abrams and O'Rourke and Gillum performances in particular as failure or success? I think a lot of your one's perspective on the election might be, were these very successful campaigns or were these disastrous campaigns where the Democrats blew a shot for huge wins?
Oh, I don't think the Democrats blew it. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the reading that these were uphill climbs, especially in Georgia and Texas, but I would say in Florida too. I feel the loss of these politicians for the Democratic Party. Like, they were exciting faces. They were bringing new ideas, ways of talking about the Democratic platform to voters. And so I think that's going to be a loss that the Democratic Party is going to feel going forward in the short term. In the medium term, I think John may be right about the changing demographics favoring Democrats more down the line. Though the Florida loss for Gillum, and we should add probably for Ben Nelson in the Senate too, is obviously a different kind of more moderate politician, but he couldn't win either in Florida, we don't think. What strikes me about that is this frustration. Democrats keep hoping this new coalition of young voters and people of color are going to emerge and it's going to be enough. And it's not quite enough yet. Now, in Georgia, that may be in part or even in large part because Stacey Abrams' opponent, Brian Kemp, who's the Secretary of State, was doing such an effective job of purging voters from the rolls. But it's just it's not winning elections quite yet. And so then the question becomes, do the Democrats just need to be patient, or in the, you know, looking at the 2020 timeline, do they need to go back to the strategy of focusing on Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan in the presidential race? Because those states seemed much more hospitable given the results in the governor's elections.
So John had to step out for some breaking news. So Emily and I are going to continue the show together. Do you read the election this week, Emily, as being a victory for the moderate wing of the Democratic Party and a repudiation of this idea of progressivism as a reasonable national strategy? Or do you think the results are mixed and in certain places, obviously, the progressives are doing fine and it's that you shouldn't draw too much out of it? Is this a lesson like, oh, the Democrats need a centrist presidential candidate in 2020 because this progressive experiment we tried was a failure. Get rid of all that Medicare for All business and let's get back to invading countries in the Middle East.
God, that's such a depressing way to spin it. I can't handle that. I think the progressives came across strongly in this election. I mean, when you look at the House results, there were some really, you know, out there liberal voices who will now be in the House of Representatives. I think the Democrats did an effective job of sticking to their healthcare message, but also running in somewhat different tones in different parts of the country. And that's a good strategy for congressional elections. How that translates into a presidential candidate seems much trickier to me. And I can see the sort of centrist argument. I actually don't think it's so much about centrist versus progressive than about someone really being a good policy-oriented, like, stick-to-the-message challenger to Trump, who is, you know, practicing his theater of distraction so effectively this week of all weeks, as he always does. And so whoever this candidate is has to be really nimble on that front. I kind of think that whatever the policy agenda is, as long as it seems authentic to that person and that candidate can really like forcefully expound on it despite all the theater, that's going to be the winning tactic. But what do you think about the lessons here?
I think a couple of things. One, there was one analysis that I saw, which I found very striking, which is that if you look at the state of the economy, which is good, the state of foreign policy, which is that we are not engaged in any disastrous wars or anything disastrous overseas right now, that the Republicans had a monumentally, extraordinarily poor performance on Tuesday. And so even though the results are certainly a mixed bag and there were disappointments for the Democrats, to read this as anything less than a massive triumph for Democrats and Democratic ideas is a mistake. And for the reasons that we've discussed, the structural reasons that make it harder for Democrats to win certain kinds of House seats and make it harder for them to win a bunch of Senate seats because these are small population, very conservative states. And so you're just totally screwed. I mean, North Dakota has probably fewer people than seven blocks in Brooklyn. But at the top level, this is a real victory for Democrats and whatever it is they stand for. And it does seem to me that the progressive ideas have currency with people, that I think people are willing to entertain them. And that just as the conservatives for many years ran on issues that were well to the right of where the public as a whole is and well to the right of where the median voter is, I think Democrats should probably take their chance to run a bit to the left of where the median voter is and not say, well, because some progressives lost and because Gillum couldn't win and Abrams couldn't win and Beto couldn't win, that the progressive ideas are a failure. People are galvanized by those ideas, and those ideas have meaning for folks. Like, people are moved by the idea of higher minimum wages and safe, you know, health care for themselves. I myself am not particularly progressive, but I would be disappointed if Democrats took the lesson that they should abandon these ideas before they've even pushed them for more than a year. As the conservatives have shown, this is not a one election project. This is a generational project to change the terms of debate.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And when you think about rising inequality, which, you know, continues to be with us, kind of masked by full employment right now, you would think that that would be a good way to create a broad coalition, one that's able to transcend racial and ethnic differences, which have obviously been exploited to such a degree by Trump before this election and continue to be. I mean, you know, the sort of caravan theater seems to have completely ended now that the election's over. There are just all these examples of distraction that remain these effective political tactics, but I think the Democrats have to figure out how not to fall into that trap. And I wonder what you think about Nancy Pelosi's leadership going forward, whether she's the right person to be leading the Democrats in the House, given all her wealth of experience and times when she's been very effective at herding the cats of the House. On the other hand, she is a total lightning rod for criticism with really low approval ratings. And that makes me really wonder about having her at the head of the party in the House right now.
I go back and forth on the Nancy Pelosi question because on the one hand, she has been around this party for too long. There's a dearth of promising youngish leaders, not young leaders, not, I'm not talking about the folks who just got elected, but the people who might be in their 40s and 50s today. There's a dearth of people who have a strong profile who are going for it and are possible alternatives to her. So I don't think there's a strong bench, which is she deserves blame for not to have cultivated people who could now step in and challenge her. That said, she's a very effective legislator, and whoever is in that role is going to be a lightning rod. We've seen that with Mitch McConnell. We've seen it with Paul Ryan. Like, it doesn't matter that Mitch McConnell has no charisma and is an unappealing person. If you are an effective legislator, you can get a lot done and withstand the people who are criticizing you and making memes about you. So I think Pelosi, for the moment, probably is their most likely an effective leader. So she should probably stick at it. My question back at you, Emily, is what is the strategy that House Democrats should pursue? They do not have the possibility of actually getting legislation passed and signed by the president, at least not the legislation they want to get passed. So what is it they should spend the next 2 years doing?
I would really like them to focus on corruption in the government. And there are, you know, different examples of that. There are investigations into various cabinet secretaries. You know, right now, Ryan Zinke's corruption possibilities seem like they deserve a good, thorough airing. I'm right now thinking a lot about the trial and the challenge to the citizenship question in the census. And I would like the Democrats, if we'll see, some of this may or all of it may come out in the trial, but I think the Democrats should try to understand what the basis was for adding this question to the census in the face of all this evidence from researchers in the Census Bureau that is going to depress turnout, especially among immigrants and other groups that are hard to count, that will have serious implications.
Not turnout. The word isn't turnout. Depress the actual count of people. It's not like a thing that people are going to do. It's like the government's job is to count everyone.
You're totally
so
right. I am using
actual count.
I'm using election words, and you're absolutely right. Depress participation in filling out the census, which every single resident of the United States is supposed to do. It's an enumeration. Anyway, I think that would be a good focus of energies. The first move Tuesday night, or at least the first like flash in the news, was about subpoenaing President Trump's tax returns. And I understand the impulse to do that. I think the country deserves to know what's in those tax returns. I also think the Democrats need to be careful not to overstep politically. They need to seem like they are proceeding in a kind of sober and responsible rather than vengeful fashion. And I'm not sure exactly why that tax returns newsflash made me nervous, but it did. And I wonder if you had a different reaction.
No, I had the same reaction. I actually think I disagree with your basic premise. It's not that I don't think they should investigate corruption. I think corruption is a massive theme of this administration, and good government is something we should all want. And therefore, of course, the House should make sure to probe into those things. But that would not be my first order of business. My first order of business, if I were a Democratic legislator, is even though I know that none of the bills that I'm going to put forward are going to become law, you want to lay down a marker and say, here's what we stand for. And so if I were, I would have very boisterous committee hearings about healthcare and about the expansion of healthcare and about strengthening Obamacare, considering, you know, Medicare for all bills. That's one thing I would do. I would take on elements of the progressive agenda, and I would try to pass kind of bills that you can get past the Democratic caucus, that you can get a, that you can get all the Democrats to vote for, or enough to pass it through the House, knowing that they're going to die in the Senate and they're never going to become law. But to make a statement saying we are serious about wanting to do good work for the American people. We're not sitting here with distraction. We're going to do good policy. And I think, again, going back to what conservatives did for many years during the Obama and to a lesser extent the Clinton presidency, to do that is extremely effective, both at keeping your base excited and also at showing that you're engaged with issues that have resonance for people. So corruption is wicked, and this administration is massively corrupt and at a level we haven't seen before. I think that is true. I don't think that that should be the first story the Democrats are telling throughout the next 2 years. It suggests they're wasting their time. Their job is to go and be legislators. So try to go and be legislators.
Yeah, you're right. I completely withdraw what I said before. I mean, I do think they need to do some investigating along the way, but I think their priority should be about policy, and that there, it's also a way of creating bills that then can be revived at some later date when you actually have control of both chambers,
right?
Presumably. And so you're right. That's a total opportunity. And you could say that you can tell that what I said earlier was semi-ridiculous because I started with Ryan Zinke, which, like, that is not the main event in Washington right now. And, like, yes, we should find out what's going on with him, but the priority should be the priorities that people have, the things that are going to really affect a lot of people's lives.
Slate Plus members, of course, get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. And we're going to have a discussion of what we think were the most overlooked races, the most overlooked campaigns of Tuesday. And we're going to discuss which ones caught our eye, but maybe didn't get the attention they deserved. Slate.com/GabFestPlus and become a member. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu. Voting rights is arguably one of the big stories of the election, the disenfranchisement of hundreds of thousands of people, their difficulty in getting ballot access in places like Florida. On the other hand, we had Florida's Amendment 4 restoring the rights to vote of ex-felons, which, as Emily Bazelon will tell you, is the most extraordinary act of enfranchisement since 18-year-olds got the right to vote, or maybe even since women won the right to vote. So, Emily, can you give us a bit of the landscape around voting rights in this election and the big issues and what happened?
Yeah. So Florida's Amendment 4, which I wrote about and I'm super interested in, got a lot of attention justifiably. I think the next big challenge will be to register all those folks to vote. So we can talk about that more in a minute. But to keep going across the country, Michigan passed a whole package of voting rights legislation. It was not legislation because it was ballot initiative. So there's going to be automatic voting voter registration in Michigan. They also changed the way that they redistrict. They're having an independent commission. Nevada also passed automatic voter registration, and the same kind of redistricting commission passed in Colorado, and I think also in Utah. So we just are seeing a kind of movement towards voting rights through ballot initiatives in the country. And I wonder if that shows that we've turned a corner on voting rights, that if you put these questions directly to voters rather than relying on legislators who may be seeing it through a partisan political lens, you can get these voting rights reforms through as kind of basic good government provisions. You know, when people are polled about gerrymandering, they don't like it. And so if you give them an option of voting for turning this over to, you know, independent, nonpartisan group of people to draw the maps, they seem to be making that choice. And that's something that could really have an impact for the future as we think about how to protect people's voting rights, how to make sure that we really have majority rule in the country, as opposed to this sort of slicing and dicing of the electorate that creates a real imbalance and stands in the way of proportional representation within a state, right? Where you have like the power of voters amplified if they're in the ruling party and then, you know, pushed way, way down if they're in the losing party.
It is a really interesting example of where the interests of the political class and the desires of voters are intrinsically in conflict, which is that legislators have such an interest in protecting themselves. And protecting themselves often means gerrymandering, often means setting up rules that make it difficult for them to lose power, to lose elections. And voters, even voters who are very partisan, don't share that belief. I don't think most voters want their vote to count and to count in a meaningful way. And they resent being used as a tool for a political class. And so while the voter manipulation and the voting rights, voter manipulation through gerrymandering and through ballot access have generally come from the right, and while Republicans in general are more sympathetic to those kinds of issues, it is also the case that all voters, even whether they're Republican or Democrat, are much less in favor of these issues than all legislators are. And so, as you say, if you make it a popular vote, you can get something done. I found the results in Florida, which I hope you'll go into, Emily, extraordinary. The fact that here in a state which is obviously divided 50-50 on when it comes to voting in politicians, the fact that you could get more than 60% of voters turning out to vote in favor of something which re-enfranchises a million plus people who are disproportionately poor, disproportionately minority, and disproportionately probably likely to vote for one party or the other, probably likely to vote for Democrats, is extraordinary. It's an act of, it shows that voters are independent of what, if legislators had to vote on it, there's no way they'd get 60% of that.
Right.
The Florida legislature to vote in favor of it.
Yeah. So yes, let's talk about Amendment 4 for a minute, because it's like my favorite topic. So first of all, it's, this amendment is came out of years of work, particularly by a man named Desmond Mead, who I wrote about for The Times Magazine, who is a former felon himself, really became the kind of heart and soul of this movement, spent years working on it without like a paid salary to directly do this work, traveling the state. And after Trump won in 2016, this movement started getting more attention from liberal donors who were willing to take a chance on it. And one of the reasons the money started coming in and Desmond's organization grew was that this provision, this amendment polled really well from the beginning. From the beginning, it was over 70%. So when I was writing about it over the summer, I still saw it as a long shot because I figured that there was enough at stake in Florida, enough of a chance that giving 1.5 million former felons the right to vote would be seen as turning Florida blue, that someone would come in hard against this ballot measure and run a bunch of attack ads, and its approval rating would go down among voters. And the amazing thing to me about this election was that never happened. Instead, evangelical groups came out in favor of the amendment, in large part because they saw it as like part of a kind of Christian view of redemption and second chances. And then the other fascinating thing to me was that the Koch brothers also declared their support for it, the Koch network, I guess I should say. They didn't actively donate to the campaign in favor of the amendment, but they did not fund the opposition. And nobody else really came in against it in an organized fashion at all. And so I think what you saw here was voters not primed by, you know, Fox News to oppose this, not given the sort of red meat and fear-mongering ads that you might have expected. They just like kind of voted in a more common sense way, or maybe from the heart, about in favor of second chances. And that's why you saw this, you know, really bipartisan supermajority support for this amendment. Now, of course, the question is registering these former felons to vote. Traditionally across the country, people who've gone to prison have a low rate of voter registration and participation in elections. But this organization that Desmond Mead has formed is in a good position now to start signing up lots of people. And there are examples of this happening also in Virginia and Louisiana, which have loosened restrictions on the voting rights of former felons too. So it's going to be really important to watch to see how effective people are in signing up these new voters. And that should be a kind of bipartisan effort about increasing participation in the democracy. There's also some interesting research that when people are registered to vote and they start identifying themselves as citizens, that that can actually like make it more likely that they get employment and that they stay away from reoffending. And that seems like a kind of almost too good to be true consequence of registering to vote. But there is some suggestive finding along those lines. And so so I'll continue to feel like excited and interested in this topic. I also want to talk a little bit about automatic voter registration. I mean, that seems like the most boring thing in the world, but it also can make a huge difference in participation rates. And we don't have it in most states. I think we also could look to the Democrats in the House to make that part of their platform, passing federal AVRs, it's called for short. And this idea that these basic, the sort of maintenance of our democracy, that they deserve real attention in ideally in both parties' platforms, that, you know, could be something really interesting to watch going forward.
Emily, did you take the same deep sort of soul-filling pleasure in Kris Kobach's defeat as I did? He is another person whose political career has been made on absolutely deceptive, false, disgusting arguments or cases around alleged and non-existent voter fraud. And to see him dismissed by the voters of Kansas was very gratifying.
Look, I mean, if you're going to talk about the 2018 elections as a victory for voting rights, you have to include the downfall of Kris Kobach, who has been just one of the main proponents of the notion that there's widespread in-person voting fraud. That is a myth. It is not widespread. Kobach has done his utmost, I would say, as the Secretary of State in Kansas to make it harder for certain groups of voters, purging the rolls in ways that seem like they're designed to particularly target minorities, I'd argue. And he just, you know, had this, I would say, embarrassing performance at a federal trial in Kansas versus the ACLU, where he just did not seem to really be able to handle himself properly in court. So, yeah, I mean, I think if you're thinking about voting rights, having Kris Kobach go down in defeat and not be the governor of Kansas is significant. We'll see what happens to him next. Somehow I doubt that we've heard the last from him.
Attorney General, United States Attorney General Kris Kobach?
Right. I mean, maybe. Would this Senate confirm him? Although I guess this morning the rumors are more about Chris Christie, just quickly looking at Twitter. But I mean, I also, well, we'll talk more about the
when you vacancy. Talk about discredited Chris, people with alliterative names.
Right. Chris. We can have a battle between Chris with a K and Chris with a C.
So one final question about the voting rights issues, Emily, is that a lot of the ones you cite, including Amendment 4 in Florida, these are state-level actions, not really reviewable by the Supreme Court. But there, a lot of what's happening around voting rights, ballot access, gerrymandering, redistricting does ultimately funnel up to the Supreme Court in the sense that there will be legal challenges and people on one side or the other will attempt to make a federal case out of it, and the Supreme Court will get some of these cases as they've gotten them in recent years. This is a very unsympathetic Supreme Court, I would suspect, towards the sort of more pro-voting rights side of the equation.
Yes. And for that reason, it's going to be really important for people who are trying to expand voting rights to do it under state law whenever they possibly can. And that's what we've seen in this past election. I mean, these are state ballot initiatives. There are possible federal challenges of the future to independent redistricting commissions. But so far, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision a few years ago said that ballot initiatives that provide for independent redistricting commissions are constitutional. So, you know, one really good example of a state-based reform is the Pennsylvania map. So this was the Pennsylvania map was redrawn this year after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that the gerrymandering that the Republican legislature had done violated the Pennsylvania Constitution. And the Supreme Court declined to review that ruling. And what we saw was a new map that divided the state 9-9 in terms of the congressional representation. So that's a much fairer map. I mean, it still advantages Republicans to a degree, but it's an example of an anti-gerrymandering change that the Supreme Court is not going to mess with.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
We were hoping to have John back by now, especially for this third topic, but unfortunately the news calls that he won't be able to join us. We are taping at a very time of busyness and tragedy, and he's got to cover it for CBS. So we're just going to go on, just me and Emily. So if you were hoping to hear John talk about Jeff Sessions, you're going to miss your chance, but you get to hear Emily talk even more about Jeff Sessions. So what could be better?
Uh-oh.
So Jefferson Sessions, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, whatever yeah. that his extraordinary name is out as Attorney General. He was fired. He was asked to resign by the president, but that means he was fired by the president the day after the election. The president has named Mark Whitaker, who is Sessions' chief of staff and politician from Iowa, as the acting Attorney General, which he can be for up to 9 months. And then even longer if there's another candidate awaiting confirmation. And Whitaker seems to have immediately taken over authority of the Mueller investigation from Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. So, Emily, big news. Should the American public be sad that Sessions is gone?
This is just the most ironic firing in the world, and I have such a split set of emotions about it. Okay, on the one hand, you know, Jeff Sessions has been an incredibly effective Trump loyalist for the Trump agenda of, you know, anti-immigrant provisions, of the sort of like law and order, of, you know, changing the way we think about civil rights and the Justice Department's responsibilities towards civil rights in the country. I mean, there are just so many ways in which he has been deeply conservative and deeply very much on the Trump train. I mean, when the Trump folks needed a high-level official to stand up in favor of family separations at the border last summer, when we were seeing kids, you know, put in cages and taken away from their parents, it was Jeff Sessions who went on television and said, this is necessary and a fair way to treat people. So if you think about the Justice Department in terms of its civil rights record, it is hard to mourn the departure of Jeff Sessions. On the other hand, Jeff Sessions has been standing between the American people and like a real serious threat to rule of law since he recused himself from the Russia investigation. Now, I would argue that Sessions didn't really have a choice.
Actually, Emily, can I interrupt you and say, I don't think it's Sessions. Sessions has not been standing. Rod Rosenstein has been standing because Sessions was not allowed to oversee the investigation. So Sessions has committed no affirmative act to protect anything. It is that he simply is not there
Well, he absented himself, right? I mean, he recused himself. Now, I don't really think he had a choice about recusing himself because he is a lawyer. And the ethics officials, you know, the people who really safeguard how ethics work at the Department of Justice told him to step aside. So in that sense, I suppose you're right. But he did make that decision, which, you know, President Trump has hated on him for and never understood. And he, like, weathered the criticism. He didn't do a whole lot to push back, but he also, merely in continuing to do his job, I should say, I suppose we should say, allowed Rod Rosenstein to supervise the Mueller investigation. And that's been this, like, you know, fragile but important compromise isn't quite the right word, but just like structure that has been allowing the Mueller investigation to go forward. And now it's gone. And now we have this acting attorney general, Mark Whitaker, who is like very much a creature of Donald Trump. He at one point, you know, used to be the U.S. attorney in Iowa. He was in private practice in Iowa. And then he started writing op-eds opposing the Mueller investigation and going on Fox News. Lo and behold, he became the chief of staff for Sessions at the Justice Department. And now he's actually the attorney general for all intents and purposes. And he announced immediately, or DOJ did, that he is taking over supervision of the Mueller investigation. And so this kind of fragile but really important structure around the Russia investigation is now gone. And we're like off in these uncharted, unclear waters. And one big question I have is just whether Mark Whitaker is a short-term placeholder or whether Trump is going to keep him in this acting attorney general job for a, you know, kind of medium, longer-term period. He can serve for at least 210 days in this role. There are questions about whether he was properly appointed, but I don't think the case for challenging the appointment itself is very strong. I do think there are questions about whether he too should be recusing himself from any involvement in supervising Mueller because he has these really strongly stated prior opinions about it. So we'll see if some ethics opinions or guidelines emerge from inside the Justice Department. But for right now, he is absolutely asserting his power to do that. And the power of supervision here includes the power to, you know, approve or deny indictments going forward or subpoenas or new areas of investigation. I mean, we're really talking about a real potential change here.
Let's dig into that a little bit, Emily. So what are the things that Attorney General, Acting Attorney General Whitaker could do to block, delay, stymie the Mueller investigation? And then on the flip side, what is it that the Mueller team or Democrats seeking to protect the Mueller team can do to fight back against those potential limits?
Well, one thing Whitaker could do, which when he was being a Fox News commentator slash op-ed writer, he said he favored, was to cut off funding for the Mueller investigation. Another thing he talked about in his previous commentator role was narrowing the scope of the investigation. And then a third thing he can do is like outright deny a request for a new investigatory tool like a subpoena or issuing an indictment. Now, I mean, that is like some serious high drama because we can assume that Mueller is gathering a lot of sets of facts, right? There is evidence collected here. That investigation has gone quiet for the last couple months because of the election. And that was absolutely the proper thing to do. And if there's one thing I think we've learned about Bob Mueller, it's that he likes to proceed in a proper by-the-book fashion. But now we're after the election. And now we would expect to hear, I would say, pretty soon from Mueller about what he's learned, who, if anyone, he's planning to indict, and what kind of report he's planning to make. And Whitaker is in a position to, you know, if he wants to, directly confront and obstruct Mueller on all of those fronts. Now, the politics of doing that, the fallout from that, I think would be significant. The chances that it would stay, you know, secret in the Justice Department that Mueller had been stymied seem super low. Mueller has also already kind of outsourced pieces of this investigation to other prosecutors like the Southern District of New York. So one would imagine that Mueller has already taken some steps to protect the investigation from interference. But I mean, if there was someone who Trump could have chosen who would interfere with Mueller, Whitaker just seems like that guy.
Whitaker also has the ability, when Mueller issues a report, to decide whether that report is made public or sent on to Congress, which, again, as you say, if that report is suppressed, you can imagine there would be absolute outrage. So I think it probably couldn't stay quiet forever, but that's another tool. I also had the understanding, Emily, and I could be wrong about this, but I feel like someone told me this, that the Mueller grand jury has a life independent of Mueller.
Yes, there is this weird.
The Mueller grand jury, the Mueller grand jury could theoretically, even if the Mueller investigation is stymied across different fronts, could pursue things that it's interested in. Now, presumably, there'd be some judge or prosecutor putting whispers in its ear about what it should be interested in.
Right. I mean, there are these various like creaky workarounds, like that idea that this grand jury could somehow take over the investigation seems a little implausible. Also, just like that is not how it's supposed to work. Like, we have a special counsel. He was given a job to do. He needs to finish that job. That's really important for just like American law functioning, for the idea that no one, including the president, is above the law. We got to just like finish that in the way it's the standard operating procedure. You know, with the Democrats taking over the House committees are going to become another route for investigations, but they don't have the power of indictment. And again, these are all possible alternatives, and presumably they will ensure that we find out what Mueller has learned, but they should not become a substitute for Mueller with his full powers of bringing indictments and pursuing criminal prosecutions. Like, there already have been a rash of important indictments that have come out of this investigation. We need to see it to the end.
We heard from Susan Collins and newly elected Utah Senator Mitt Romney that it was very important for Mueller to complete his investigation, and somehow suggesting that they would protect that investigation. The idea that Republican senators are going to stand against Trump and protect that investigation seems to me that's a faint-hearted hope that people should have. They have not been strong in protecting Mueller at all. There's no reason to think they're going to start being strong now. So I know there are people who feel like, well, Romney and Collins carry weight and have moral authority and are good people, and I hope that's true, but I don't hold out too much hope that they would be able to stop something that's bad news for this investigation.
I mean, can we please be spared from like Mitt Romney taking over from Jeff Flake as the next person who we have to see like endless pictures of like pained expressions and expressions of like concern and regret? I just like spare me.
Let's practice our pained expression. I'll do my Mitt Romney pained expression. All right, we're going to take for just like 2 seconds on the air. Did you do yours?
I did, mine. But I don't think that was very effective radio, our pained expressions that nobody can see.
Mine was pained. It was pain. It sort of was pained, a little bit of sanctimony.
Did you make sure to furrow your brow? I think the brow
furrowing
is key.
I sort of squeezed my lips in an interesting way.
Flake always like looks down. I always feel like I'm looking at some like, you know, Renaissance portrait of someone looking, you know, slightly mysterious in his pained expression.
I have one other angle of questioning for you, Ms. Bazelon. So if the House committee, the House, is it Ways and Means? Who can ask for Trump's taxes? There is the committee that can ask for Trump's tax returns now. If they ask for his taxes, what possible legal defenses does he has? How can the mechanism of the Department of Justice help him not give those taxes up?
Actually think that's about the Department of Justice. I think that is about whoever the new White House counsel is and an assertion of executive privilege and a big fight over the scope of the power Congress has to subpoena and investigate the executive branch. And it would end up being a big separation of powers clash that could presumably go to the Supreme Court. You know, that seems like it could be on the horizon. And again, I think I'm so torn here because I really do think we deserve to know what's in those tax returns. And on the other hand, the political theater that and the energy and oxygen that's going to suck up, that's going to be really significant politically.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. Emily, it's like where I am. It's so early in the morning, and yet I could really use a drink. I just saw this Ruth Bader Ginsburg news flash across the screen.
Yeah, she broke three ribs, huh?
It's too chaotic. There's too much. There's too much happening. I need a stiff drink. When you have your stiff drink and start babbling incoherently, what are you going to be babbling incoherently about?
Oh, man. I feel like all weekend people are going to be worrying about the health of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We, of course, wish her a speedy recovery. It really hurts to break your ribs. I was really interested in how criminal justice reform issues played out on Tuesday. And so I'm going to tease our Slate Plus segment by talking about one other amendment. Louisiana ended the practice of convicting people based on juries that are not unanimous. And that means now only Oregon has this practice of convicting people of felonies with a jury that doesn't entirely agree. And that just seems like absolutely the right move to be making. It's odd in a sense that the Constitution doesn't require unanimous juries, but we've had states that had this practice. And it seems like it's really important to make sure that everybody who hears the case thinks that someone is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The law has been moving in this direction for a little while now. Florida used to let non-unanimous juries send people to the death penalty, and Alabama used to do that too. So this is good news for justice that we're seeing the diminishing of this practice.
All right. My chatter is much more trivial, which is that last weekend, family went on an outing in hometown of Washington, D.C., and we went to the National Arboretum, which is a wonderful place, which you should definitely go to for all sorts of reasons. But we went to something which I somehow miraculously, despite having grown up in Washington, had never seen before, which is the bonsai exhibit at the U.S. National Arboretum. And this arboretum has the most remarkable collection of bonsai. I don't know if it's one of the great collections in the world because I'm not a bonsai connoisseur, but it's a beautiful, gorgeous, fascinating, delightful collection of bonsai. There's trees that survived the Hiroshima bombing. There are trees that are 400 or 500 years old. There's these serene little dioramas of tree, and they're absolutely beautiful. And it's very soothing to just walk around and look at them and look at these trees, which are normally on a massive scale, at this tiny little scale and these beautiful little worlds that they're created. I don't know what is so reassuring to me, what is so nice to live in a Lilliputian world and to be a giant among these trees, but it is really remarkably soothing. So if you get the chance, go see the Arboretum bonsai exhibit in Washington, D.C. Also, we have been collecting your listener chatters. Thank you for those. And you please keep them coming. And also, please send us conundrums, too. I forgot to mention that at Slate Gabfest. Send us your great conundrums, but keep sending us your listener chatter, something that you find fascinating or disturbing or delightful that you are going to be talking about at your cocktail party. The listener chatter for this week comes to us courtesy of at David Amon. David Amon recommends a blog post by Jay Rosen of NYU, who's a media critic, media observer. And it's a story about this: how to take the citizen's agenda in campaign journalism. It's Rosen looking back at an experiment that was tried by a North Carolina newspaper more than 20 years ago to cover the election by asking a totally different set of questions than reporters usually cover it. It's rather than sort of horse race questions, the only thing they asked was they asked citizens, what do you want the candidates to be discussing as they compete for votes? And every story they did was about what the public actually wanted to hear from candidates. So they ignored the sort of noise and the the distraction, which is all we've heard from, you know, the caravan nonsense, and instead simply focused on asking candidates and getting candidates to discuss the issues that voters said they wanted to discuss. And that was the focus of how this newspaper covered it. And it was, you know, edifying and successful. And, you know, I think journalists have a hard job and political journalists have a very hard job. And there's not one single way to do campaign journalism. But this is an interesting, different, and inspiring idea for how campaign coverage could work.
I just love that someone tried that. That's great.
That is our show for today. GabFest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Thanks to the whole teams of people in every time zone who have helped us today. It's been a very tricky show to put together. So thanks to all of the many efforts that have done that. We are, again, sorry, John couldn't make it for the whole show. But he will, of course, be back with us next week. You should follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet conundrums and cocktail chatter to us at @SlateGabFest. For Emily and John, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ever listen to podcasts with your kids? It's a great way to keep them entertained and engage their minds without relying on screens. I want to tell you about a new kids' history podcast hosted by me, Joy Dolo. It's called Forever Ago, and I teamed up with the producers of the award-winning kids' podcast, Brains On, to make it. Forever Ago dives into the amazing backstories of everyday stuff, like emojis, video games, and skateboards. We use games, skits, and kid co-hosts to keep the whole family engaged, while teaching listeners to think critically about history. Along the way, we'll hear some incredible stories, like how a curious teenager revolutionized skateboarding.
Gnarly.
How alarm clocks used to just be people.
Rise and shine.
And how the poop emoji almost didn't happen. You can find Forever Ago on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.